And then there are handouts provided for Brother David's discourse. If you haven't received one, please raise your hand and we'll come around and find you. Sister Carol doesn't have one. My pleasure now to turn the platform over to Brother David Duran, and his subject is an overview of Matthew 24. Brother David.
I am not a Russellite. However, I do believe the Lord used the man as a messenger to the seventh stage of the church. I don't think that any thinking, studious Christian will ever say, I agree with everything Brother Russell said. But I think it's incumbent upon us to disagree judiciously, which means we'll probably end up disagreeing only with the slightest little things because our own minds are peculiar. I think we all realize that there are many commentators in the Christian world over the recent centuries who have interpreted the whole Bible erroneously. And to interpret the whole Bible is something actually beyond the scope of possibility in the mind of a single man. So what does the Lord do when he sends a messenger to a particular stage of the church? I think what he does is send through him those foundations, those fundamentals, those basics that allow that stage of the church to build upon what has been taught. I think you realize there are many parts of the Bible Brother Russell never touches. Of course, that doesn't mean we're not supposed to touch them. But just stop and think about the parts that he touched with such incredible insight. Parts that became the formulae for our understanding of the rest of the Bible. You know, in those old science fiction movies, the mad scientist and somebody's after it. Give me the formula. Give me the formula. It's all they want, the formula. Because the formula is going to open up everything. And this is precisely the point with the messengers to the various stages of the church. There's the formula. There's the one basic understanding that allows other things to open up. And so what is Brother Russell allowed to do? He sees Leviticus 8:9-16. Incredible clarity. He sees Daniel 8:9-11-12. Incredible clarity. He sees chapters in Hebrews. Incredible clarity. He sees Revelation 12. Incredible detail and clarity. He sees Matthew 24. Incredible clarity. How many chapters have I mentioned? You can count them on two hands. But from these, all else has become clear. Because these are such fundamental chapters in Scripture that all else relates to them. I would never suggest that somebody's losing his crown because of deviant understandings from these basic interpretations that we receive from Brother Russell. However, I personally grieve for, have extreme concern for, worry for, pray for, all who have rather flippantly cast aside these most important interpretations. So I'm not a Russellite, but I wouldn't be much of a Christian without Brother Russell. We would like to look today with you at a basic overview of Matthew 24, normally called our Lord's Great Prophecy, just to see the concepts that we glean from Brother Russell's writings on it. I'm not interested in detail in the chapter today. That can take hours and hours and hours. I may not even fill an hour here, but that's not our objective. Our objective is just to see how this thing is glued together, because scriptures, when you really see their clarity, are extremely rational and orderly. And when you first read Matthew 24, it's such a hodgepodge of loose ends. You think, well, where's it going? Why did it do that now? But Brother Russell explained pretty much why it did it. And if we see the explanation, if we see the architecture of this chapter, perhaps the detail later will become much easier for us. Know the hymn we just sang, 171. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the presence of the Lord. Remember Revelation 18:1? After these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. Too often we look to that future, which will be glorious, and we equate that with the glory of the Lord, but that's not what the scriptures say. Right here in 18:1 of Revelation, at the time the Lord returned, the whole earth was illumined with his glory. We have seen that, and it's made us tingle. And that's part of what Matthew 24 does for us. Let's look at it. The handout you have is there for kind of a visual help in seeing how things are put together. The chapter starts with just a basic setting and some questions. I rather suspect divinely inspired questions. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he answered and said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly, I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another, which will not be torn down." And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your parousia and of the end of the age?" That's the setting. Obviously, part of the question had to do with the destruction of the temple buildings. But part of it, probably by inspiration, has to do with his coming back. I mean, at this point, they probably weren't even much aware of the concept that he was going anywhere. And yet they're asking about his coming back. Four through eight is one view of the gospel age. And the reason that this chapter is laid out the way it is laid out is Jesus starts focusing immediately on the question of his return, his presence, his parousia. And he has to make very clear the concept that it's going to be a long time. And he does this two ways. He takes verses 4 through 8 to show what's going to happen basically in the secular world. Then he returns to the subject in verses 9 through 14 to show what's going to happen in the religious world. Then he focuses in on the harvest from various viewpoints. So many commentators, of course, take parts in the verses 4 through 14 and tend to apply them at this end of the age. They were not meant for that. That's not the concept of verses 4 through 14. Those verses are all gone. You know, the same problem occurs when people interpret Revelation. They all look at it and say, oh, this is all the end of the age. And most Revelation's all gone. Right here, these verses 4 through 14, a big chunk of Matthew 24, it's all gone. Don't look for it. It's past. Let's take 4 through 8. And Jesus answered and said to them, see to it that no one misleads you. Very first warning. Everybody's going to have some idea about his return. And there'll be all kinds of opportunities to misunderstand it. Very first thing he says, don't get misled on this subject. You know, Paul says the same thing in Thessalonians. Don't get all worked up over the Lord's return. He says, first there's got to be a falling away and the man of sin has to be revealed. All these things have to happen first. Jesus is using the same approach the Apostle Paul did. Don't get worked up here right at the beginning. See that no one misleads you, because all these things I'm going to tell you about now have to happen first. Many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not frightened. Very casual statement, isn't it? I mean, if you're listening to Jesus, he's saying there's going to be wars, there's going to be rumors about other wars. Don't get upset. We're not talking about something imminent here. We're talking about something long distance. For those things must take place. But that is not yet the end. Don't get misled because you see a lot of wars. That's not a sign of my presence. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. So Jesus is saying, these things are not signs of my parousia. These things I'm telling you about because you're going to see them, and I don't want you even to pay attention to them. They'll come, they'll go, let them come, let them go. It's not what you're looking for. You notice just about everything there in those verses is secular. Wars, nations being born and dying, famines, earthquakes. He's not talking about spiritual things here. He's simply talking about secular history for a couple thousand years. Even the way it opens up, many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ. Well, Israel was expecting Messiah. But you know how Israel was expecting Messiah. They weren't expecting Messiah as a great religious revealer. They were expecting Messiah as somebody to get the Roman yoke off their shoulders. This is really a secular four verses. It's talking about events in the non-religious world. Now Jesus is going to turn around and say, now let's look at that same period over again, because you could get excited about other things and I don't want you to. Just like you're not going to get excited about famines, earthquakes, wars, and the birth and death of nations. You know, when it says nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom, he's not talking about wars. He already mentioned that. He's talking about the birth and death of kingdoms. That takes a long time. Nine through 14. Then, when, not afterward, but concurrently, during the time that he just told us about. Then, now we're going to see the religious application, the thing that's going to happen to the disciples during this period. Then, they will deliver you to tribulation
Your King James doesn't say that, does it? And it's a real weakness for reasons we will see later. But your King James doesn't use tribulation there, does he? Then they will deliver you to tribulation. If you use a King James, get tribulation in there in your own handwriting. You're going to need it, because later on this chapter depends on it. Then, during this period I just told you about, you will be delivered to tribulation. They will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Well, right there you've got some time involved, because Christians weren't in all nations. And at that time, many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all nations, and then the end shall come. Now, it's real clear here, the focus of these four verses. He's not worried about politics. He's not worried about wars. He's not worried about famines. He's very clearly, well, not worried, but very clearly informing the disciples that what 4 through 8 told them about in political affairs is going to be an unfortunately uncomfortable time for true Christians. He's basically saying you're sitting at the beginning of 2,000 years of spiritual misery. That's what verses 9 to 14 are telling the disciples. It's all past. It's all history. Don't apply any of those things that we just read about to the end of the age. They don't apply. And that's why we now get to the pivot verse where Jesus is going to lead us into the harvest and start answering the question that the disciples, by inspiration, asked. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let all these following things happen. He says, finally, you will get to a place historically where you can look backward. And you can see this thing that Daniel prophesied as having occurred, having been developed, having taken its place in the holy. That's when the harvest will have come. Now, before we look at more verses here, notice on your outline, I've attempted to divide the harvest summaries into five parts, and I believe they're set down most logically. One of the first things in the harvest, which we see in Revelation 18, is come out of her, my people. And that's precisely how Jesus is going to start his discussion of the harvest in verses 15 through 22. He says, when we've gone through all these things that you've just seen, there is a time when you're going to recognize this abomination of desolation. It's going to be time to separate yourselves because things are going to start happening. So the first thing is, come out of her. That's imperative. If you don't do that much, the rest of the chapter isn't going to be much help to you. The next part, verses 23 to 28, is describing the nature of this period of time when you're supposed to be coming out. He says it's going to be a time of information. Probably pick that up from Daniel 12, don't you think? It's going to be a time of information. And he points out true information and false. So he's saying this whole concept of coming out is going to be made a little bit difficult because there's not only going to be a lot of truth, but there's going to be a lot of contradiction. Time of information when it's time to come out. So naturally, in the disciples' minds, the question is going to be, okay, time's going to come, we're supposed to leave something, and there's going to be information, but how's it going to be accomplished if there's good information and bad? And so Jesus takes the next verses, 29 through 31, and he says, here's how I'm going to accomplish this harvesting. Here's how I'm going to accomplish this separating that I just told you has to happen in this time of increased information. And naturally the disciples would think, how are we going to be certain of the time? And so in 32 through 36, he answers that. He says, the primary indicator of timing will be there. You will be able to see something that says, now is it. Something is different now from all other times. And in 37 through 44, he says, despite all this happening, I mean, I've just told you about some wonderful things, increases of knowledge, harvesting going on, you're going to be able to see a sign with your eyes to know it's the right time. And then he says, however, it's going to be secret. That's a real accomplishment, isn't it? But Jesus is pointing out that all this is going to be done so that only the saints would know it's occurring. Very hard accomplishment. But that is basically now what these verses do. Very quickly, let's look through them. 15 through 22, come out of her, my people. Not much detail, I won't talk about that. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is in the housetop not go down to get the things out of his house. Let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak, but woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days, but pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Okay, that's come out of her, my people. Very clearly, it's saying, get out regardless of the conditions. And the conditions will get bad. Notice, please, because we'll need it later. Tribulation in verse 21. We had tribulation back in verse 9. We find it once again in 21. Do you see? There are two tribulations. Back in verse 9, it was during the gospel age, wasn't it? They will deliver you to tribulation. That's where your King James hides it from you. 21, then there will be great tribulation such as not occurred. Different tribulation. Keep the two in mind. Okay. Verses 23 to 28. Jesus is going to say, now, this time I just told you to come out. Lots of information, true and false. Then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If, therefore, they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go forth. Or behold, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east, the bright shiner comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the presence of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Okay. There's obviously going to be good information, which he calls by the unfortunate word corpse. That's the good information. And there's obviously a lot of bad information. People saying, here it is, there it is, this is what it's like, this is what it's like. He says, don't fall for it all. It's going to be everywhere. Do you see the orderliness here in these sections? They're not random. All those verses we just read have one point. Now, they have millions of little points in them, but they have one point. And that point is there are going to be claims all over the place. 29 through 31. He's saying, here's how I'm going to get you out. Here is how the harvesting is going to be accomplished in the midst of all of these claims, true and false. 29 to 31. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. He says, here's how I'm going to accomplish it. I think we ought to focus in on a little bit of that. Just a little bit, at least. Immediately after the tribulation of those days. We have seen two tribulations, haven't we? One in verse 9, one in verse 21. It can't possibly be referring to the one in verse 21. Because the one in verse 21 is the time of trouble such as never there was. Unless the Lord puts an end to it, everybody's going to die. Now, are you going to have harvesting of the church after the Lord puts an end to the trouble? No. It's very clear which tribulation Jesus is referring to. He's referring to the tribulation that he mentioned back in verse 9. The tribulation of the whole gospel age. And do you see how that fits into the architecture of Jesus' sermon? I mean, when's he going to start taking the church out? He's backing up. He said, you're going to suffer for this whole period, and immediately after the tribulation of this, that's when I'm going to start this harvest work. That's when I'm going to start taking you out, just like I told you in verses 15 to 22. It's so logical. These verses are very clearly Jesus saying, here is how, I'm cutting back in my explanation now to where we were before. This is how I'm going to take you out of her, my people. This is how, during the time of all this conflicting information that I told you about, this is how and when I'm going to take you out of her. After the tribulation of those days, after those miserable years of the whole gospel age, you are going to see the gospel light darken, the light of the Jewish law not giving its light, the teachers falling from their spirituality, the powers of Christendom being shaken by the Enlightenment. You're going to see that. Huh? That's the time of the end picture, isn't it? Now he answers their question in verse 30. He doesn't tell them what the sign is. They asked him, what'll be the sign of your presence? Jesus said, I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to tell you where it is and when it is. After you see the Enlightenment come, verse 29, you are going to see this sign you're asking about in heaven. You're going to see it in the religious world. And you're going to see it then, after the Enlightenment, after the French Revolution. Brethren have suggested all kinds of things. Brother Russell suggests what this sign is, but you have to read between the lines. In volume 4, in the chapter on our Lord's great prophecy, if you read carefully, he says he's the sign. He's the sign. That, by the way, is one of the secrets of interpreting Revelation. You've got to know who some of these angels are, and Brother Russell is a prominent one there. If you don't see Brother Russell in the Lord's plan, you're blind to prophetic fulfillment. You cannot understand what it's about. And that's precisely what Jesus is saying here. Later on in the chapter, he's going to elaborate a bit. But in essence, he's saying, look in the religious world. At that time, you're going to see the sign. That sign is the seventh messenger to the church. That's all you're going to need, because he's going to tell you everything you need to know. And then what's going to happen? Well, he already said there's going to be all this trouble, and he repeats it. He said, now all the tribes of the earth are going to start mourning. Why? Because their society's falling apart. And they will see the Son of Man coming, not parousia. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. They'll see in the trouble that it's time for Jesus' return, just like all men were in expectation at the first advent. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And they do. Turn on your radio on Sunday morning. You hear the preacher. You see all the trouble, he'll say. That means Jesus is coming. Well, that isn't what it means at all. But Jesus knew they would be saying that and seeing that, and he says it here. He says, they will see him coming. You'll see me here. You get the contrast? They see him coming. We see him here. What a dramatic contrast. And then he sends us who see him out as angels with that great trumpet. You see, that where did this trumpet come from? The trumpet is the sign of verse 30, and all of a sudden he's building on it in 31, and he says, those who see me present, they will with the great trumpet go to gather the rest of the elect. So this is how the harvest is accomplished. 32 through 36, the primary indicator of timing. Now, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see all these things, recognize that it, not he, is near, right at the door. It is summer, by the way. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. So the primary indicator of timing is the fig tree, the Jewish nation, which begins its reestablishment in 1878, takes on tremendous profession as a state in 1948, and holds the center of the world's news to our day. That means summer is near. Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. This generation will not pass away. Now, all kinds of speculation, of course, has gone into what that means. I really think it's fairly clear from Jesus' own usage. Just a little bit earlier in chapter 23, he would, well, look at it. In 23:35, speaking to the Jews at the first advent, upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom ye murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation. Well, what did he mean? He didn't mean 70 years. He didn't mean 120 years. He meant something extremely practical, because when you're talking to people and they want to know what's happening, you got to give them an answer that has meaning to them. And basically back then he said to those Jews he was speaking to, you, who are right in front of me now, most of you are going to see this happen. This generation, you're going to see it happen. And they did. Now, this is almost still the same sermon. They moved over and talking a little bit in a different locality, but it's still the same sermon. And he uses this same expression now about the second advent, and he says, you watch that fig tree. When you see the leaves on it, you who see those fig tree leaves come, you can expect this in your lifetime. It's not a number of years. It's a bunch of people. You may expect it in your lifetime. That puts it very close before us. Then he continues, this will all be done in secret, 37 to 44. For the presence of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah, for as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and were marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so shall the presence of the Son of Man be. Then there shall be two in the field, one will be taken, one will be left, two grinding at the mill, one taken, one left. Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Okay. It'll all be accomplished in secret. By the way, I think setting a date for the establishment of the kingdom is futile. You notice Jesus' words in 36. What do they refer to? He talked in 35 about heaven and earth passing away. And he says, but of that day and hour knoweth no one, not even the Son. Now, if Jesus doesn't know, and I suspect even at this point in time, Jesus doesn't know when you're going to reach the dotted line on the chart. The passing of heaven and earth. That's his subject there. Why do we want to try to find it? And of course, the next few verses tell us, this is going to be kept secret from the world. And he said, you just be ready. It'll come at the right time. Just get yourself ready. I don't even know what the date's going to be. Get yourself ready. These are the signs. I can't tell you any more than if you saw Israel put on leaves, it's in your lifetime. That ought to be enough to tell you to get yourself ready. Okay. That basically is Jesus' answer to their question. Out 8 verses telling them about the whole age, then these verses telling us in wonderful sequence about the nature of the harvest and how it will be accomplished. And now he says, and I think referring back to verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man, and verse 31, the great trumpet, he's saying, if you haven't got it yet, don't worry about it. Because who then is that faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? If you're not sure about the things I just told you, there'll be someone there to tell you about them and make them surer. Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. There is the tie-in from verse 30 and verse 31. The sign of the Son of Man in heaven, the great trumpet, that faithful and sensible slave. Then as we learned yesterday, there are always some of us who get up here behind this podium who become Nouveau Diotrephes. It happens very easily. Moses, the meekest man in all the earth. Shall we smite this rock? It's so easy. And therefore so appropriate that at this point, Jesus, having explained everything that was happening, Jesus saying, I'm going to give it into the hands of Brother Russell to tell you about. He says to Brother Russell, I think. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master lingers and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that slave will have come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour which he does not know, and shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and the gnashing of teeth. I think it's a warning. How would you feel if you had to bear the responsibility of carrying the jewels that Brother Russell had to deliver to us. Can you even imagine being entrusted with all that we have collectively in one man who had to get up on a platform and hand it out? Okay, well, I think we're just about done here. I hope you see the orderliness of this chapter. I've never heard anyone's explanation so clear as Brother Russell's. So obviously in harmony with the way that the chapter is laid out. We've looked at the fig tree generation. We've looked at the tribulation. We've looked at the sign. Let's conclude just by the last part on your outline, the deception warnings. It is kind of interesting that there are three warnings in this chapter against deceptions. One at the beginning of the age, one during the age, one at the end of the age. And the way they differ is significant. Verse 5, many will come in my name saying, I'm Messiah. Now that was logical at the beginning of the age, wasn't it? And there were many, 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 many Jewish messiahs because they didn't accept Jesus. So they were still looking for a Messiah. All men were expectation of Messiah. They had to find somebody someplace. And so all kinds of people had Messiah pinned on them. But Christians accepted who Jesus was. They knew he was Messiah. So when you get further down into the age, nobody's going to come along and say, Jesus isn't Messiah. That man over there is. That won't go over. So what happens? In the middle of the age, verse 11, many false prophets will arise and mislead many. A false Messiah won't work now. False prophets, that's another thing. And there were plenty of them during the centuries that followed the deaths of the apostles. They're still around. It wasn't difficult to be a false prophet. Almost impossible to be a false Messiah. However, as we come to the time we live in now, the harvest of the age. You know, Christianity's falling apart. It has all kinds of strange permutations. So much so that a lot of Christians are even leaving Christianity for Eastern religions. The concept of who or what Messiah is isn't so strong anymore. So when you get to verse 24, the harvest, false Christ and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. There have been and are people now alive who say, I am Messiah. What's that man from Korea? What was his name? Ah, Moon, yes. You'd think if he was Messiah, at least his name would be Sun. Well, it was Sun Moon, that's right. Okay. The point is, it is possible now for people to actually get followings when they say, I'm Messiah. That's how weak Jesus is in the minds of people. So we've come full swing. We are now down at the end of the age where false messiahs and false prophets can both exist. Very interesting picture of the age, going from false messiahs to false prophets, back to where you can have either one of them again. All right, all this was simply for the purpose of saying this chapter, which Brother Russell delineates in great detail in Volume 4 of Studies in the Scriptures, is one of the keystones to prophetic interpretation at the end of the age. A lot of people have gone other ways than Brother Russell's interpretation of it, I think to their own spiritual detriment. This one doesn't deserve tampering with. May the Lord bless us all.
Thank you, Brother David, for the excellent treatment, the overview of Matthew 24. Certainly a vital chapter for us to understand correctly. Brother David will dismiss us with prayer, ask a word of blessing on our meal, and we will reconvene for a testimony meeting at 2 o'clock. I won't have any further announcements afterwards, except just to remind you that the book table will be closed after lunch, so if you want to make any purchases, do it right now.
Our Holy Father, Abba Father, please hold our hand as we walk through the narrow way.
We are grateful that our eyes can see the glory of the works of thy Son in the earth today. Help us to be ready for that closing of the door which seems so imminent for this generation. Please bless us in our fellowship to that end. Please grant thy presence of thine angels with us as we travel. Please bless the food we partake of, that it will strengthen us temporarily, that our spirits can grow. For we do ask it all in Jesus' name.